During the American Revolution, Charles Lynch served as a justice of the peace, and he oversaw the county court in Bedford County, Virginia. Charles Lynch was a wealthy landowner and a tobacco farmer. He served in the Virginia militia as a colonel. And while he was a judge during the Revolutionary War, Lynch and several other militia officers rounded up suspects in Southern Virginia who were thought to be part of an uprising by those who were loyal to the British. These suspects that they gathered were given a summary trial at an informal court, not official. Sentences handed down to these people included whipping, property seizure, coerced pledges of allegiance, and conscription into the military. These actions were taken outside the bounds of any judicial process. In other words, it wasn't legal. Lynch defended his efforts as being the necessities of war. In time, however, Lynch became concerned that he might be charged for those actions, and so he appealed to his friends. He had friends in the Congress of the Confederation, and this was the precursor to the Congress that we have today. And Lynch requested that they protect him and his associates for what he had done. And the Congress did so. And they passed a law which proved at the time to be extremely controversial. And this law, which protected these men, became known as Lynch's Law. And it's from this that we get the term lynch or lynching. Originally, the term lynch described the organized but unauthorized punishment of criminals. Particularly in the American West, lynchings were used to serve frontier justice in places where courts did not exist. A person would be tried and lynched, but not necessarily killed. The punishment was more often a tarring and feathering or beatings or floggings like that. However, starting in the 1830s, the meaning of this word lynch shifted. It came to describe something different. Lynching came to identify non-judicial, premeditated murder committed by a group of people. And typically, this form of murder was hanging, although it could be shooting, stabbing, beating, drowning, or any other means. Although the perpetrators argued that they were taking the law into their own hands, the law had little to do with it. In the 1830s, in the 1840s, and even in the 1850s, most of the victims of lynchings were white men. But this changed during the Civil War and Reconstruction and even into the 1940s and 50s when the victims of lynchings were mostly African American. Lynchings were also predominantly carried out in the southern states. Now, quantifying the number of lynchings that have taken place in our country is complicated. Records are incomplete or intentionally non-existent. And it doesn't help that coroners would often list the cause of death for a hanging victim as suicide. The best numbers available right now tell us that in the United States, between 1877 and 1950, within the 12 southern states, there were 4,084 racial terror lynchings, which can be documented. The real number is likely much higher. There were also about 300 additional lynchings outside the South during this period. So the numbers are about 4,400 total. Lynchings are a form of terrorism. Their purpose is to instill fear into a group of people, usually a specific race of people. And most lynchings in the U.S. were acts of murder carried out with impunity, sometimes in broad daylight, often on the courthouse lawn. No lynching can be justified as frontier justice if it's committed in a community where there is a functioning criminal justice system. Terror lynchings were horrific acts of violence whose perpetrators were rarely held accountable. Many lynchings were held as public spectacles. One lynching in Jackson, Mississippi in 1919 was announced in the newspaper. The front page headline of that paper read, "John Hartfield will be lynched by Ellisville mob at 5 o'clock this afternoon." Public lynchings were attended by hundreds, if not thousands, of people in a carnival-like atmosphere with vendors selling food. At some of these lynchings, printers set up shop and sold souvenir postcards of the actual event moments after it took place. I found several of these postcards for sale on eBay. This week, I have reviewed numerous accounts of lynchings, and they are all horrific. Most were not against any convicted criminal, but rather just heinous acts of evil. Whites seeking to establish racial domination over blacks to prevent blacks from voting or having businesses or competing for jobs, from entering certain sections of town, or for even living in a community. I'm not going to read to you any of the reports of specific lynchings because, as I said, they are all horrific. And rarely were they just a simple hanging. They almost always involved violence and prolonged torture. And sadly, lynchings work. They do induce terror. Blacks fled some towns and even evacuated entire counties. In the first half of the 1900s, lynchings fueled the mass migration of millions of black people from the South up to the North or out to the West. More than half of lynching victims were killed under the accusation of committing a serious crime. After their deaths, however, predictably, many were found to be innocent. Hundreds of blacks also died in mass killings across the South in this time period, simply, often, for attempting to exercise their right to vote. Many African Americans were lynched on the thin accusation of a minor social infraction. These lynchings, like all, were clearly a tool of racial control designed to enforce social norms and racial hierarchy. For example, in 1940, Jesse Thornton was lynched in Laverne, Alabama, for referring to a white police officer by his name, but leaving off the title of Mr. In 1916, in Cedar Bluff, Mississippi, Jeff Brown was lynched for accidentally bumping into a white woman as he ran to catch a train. Lynchings are not simply acts of murder, but they represent the decay of society. They reveal the abandonment of true justice. When the mob is allowed to exert its power, justice takes a back seat. And that is what brings us to the prophet Amos and his words on justice. In the ancient Middle East, cities constructed walls for protection. Without a wall, the city was vulnerable to attack from armies and bandits. A walled city offered security for those within the city. Walls, however, needed gates to allow the residents ingress and egress from the city. Space inside a city was limited and often very crowded, and the town's gate provided a crucial community gathering point. The gate was where people naturally tended to hang out. The gate was the place where you could see everybody entering or leaving the city. The gate was a good place to share news and catch up on gossip and visit with friends. But the gate was also the place to do business. The elders of the city, the elders, you know, a group that likes to gather at Hardee's for coffee in the morning, they were the ones who would gather at the gate. If you needed witnesses for a land transaction or a divorce, you would go to the gate. There would be witnesses there. Those elders at the gate could also be called upon to act as judges for people with disputes. For example, we read this in the book of Deuteronomy. If someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father and mother, who does not heed them when they discipline him, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders of the town at the gate. The gate served as the heart of the life of the community. A healthy city had a healthy gate. A healthy gate was a place of justice. Our reading for today from the book of Amos begins with Amos's words denouncing the corruption of justice that he witnesses at the gate of the city of Samaria. Samaria was the capital of the kingdom of Israel. Amos is the 7th century BC prophet who traveled to Israel to proclaim God's word to the wealthy and the powerful of that nation. Those people, Amos argued, had turned away from their God. And the list of transgressions that Amos offers us is long. These people abused the vulnerable for their own profit. They betrayed the innocent for money. They sold the needy for a pair of sandals. They oppressed the weak. About these people, Amos tells us that they hate it when truth is spoken at the gate. Why? Because they profit off of the lies and corruption. The gate should be a place for truth. But these people use their power and their money to twist the system to their benefit, to the detriment of others. Amos complains that at the gate, the innocent are unable to obtain justice. At the gate, the judges have been bribed. At the gate, those who come seeking assistance, they're shoved aside. They're ignored. Justice is not found at this gate. Today, when we think of justice, we tend to think of balance. Someone injures me, so I should be able to injure them back, to seek my vengeance. And that seems fair, doesn't it? One act balances out another. The scales are made equal. We view justice as something that we create ourselves through laws and through systems. We make justice, don't we? Prophet Amos, however, he views justice in a different way. For Amos, justice is not something that we make ourselves, but justice is rather a divine quality created by God. Justice is an underlying foundation of our world. Just as at creation, God poured out the waters of the sea, so God also poured out justice so that it covers our land. And this justice, once God pours it out, it doesn't go away. It doesn't evaporate, but it can be covered up and lost. Imagine a beautiful meadow full of wildflowers. It's a glorious place. But then people start dumping their garbage on this meadow, and they keep doing this until the meadow is completely buried under a sea of trash. Technically, this meadow's still present. It's there. It's just hidden under the trash. You can't see it. You can't enjoy it. And if you want to experience the beauty of the meadow, then that trash has got to be removed. That trash is like the injustice that covers up the beautiful thing that God poured out for us. We can't make justice, but we can surely make injustice. Those of us, as people of faith, we believe that God is love. And God is indeed love. But love requires justice. I can't love my neighbor unless there is a just relationship between us. And God's justice, it demands a way of living in which all people are treated fairly and equally, in which the powerful don't abuse their power for their own gain at the expense of others. When justice at the gate is buried, society becomes broken. It is not what God intends for us. Injustice is evil. It is sin. Injustice is the opposite of God. Amos calls to the people saying, "Seek God. Seek God so that you may live." So how do we seek God? Well, Amos explains it to us here. He says, if you want to live, if you want to live with God, if you want to live as God's people and inhabit God's kingdom, you must do three things. You must hate evil. That means we must turn our hearts against sin, that we must no longer tolerate any transgression. We must no longer accept the presence of evil in our world. We must hate evil. And second, we must love God. We must love God with all our being, not just part of it. As we read in the book of Deuteronomy, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might." Hating evil is not enough. We must also love our God. And then third, Amos commands us in this reading today, establish justice in the gate. I believe it is safe to say that no one here, no one listening to me, has participated in a lynching. But what are we doing to establish justice in the gate? It's not enough simply not to have done something, but we must seek to eradicate the injustice that we find in our world. Yes, we lead good lives. We treat people fairly and with respect. But what are we doing to remove the generations of trash that's been dumped in that meadow? The slavery, the lynchings, the continued oppression and discrimination. What are we doing to dismantle that which obstructs God's justice? But when we do witness injustice, and we do witness it in our lives, do we choose to speak out? This was one problem with lynchings. They enforced a code of silence among the whites. No one spoke about them afterwards, and we still don't. I certainly didn't learn about lynchings in my high school history classes in Alabama. Civil War history was mostly about battles, and the only thing that I was taught about Reconstruction was about the evil carpetbaggers that came down. Amos tells us that in evil times, the prudent will keep silence. How many of us are prudent, or wise, or smart, or canny? And how many of us, because of this, choose to keep silent in the face of injustice? After all, that's the smart thing to do. If there's evil around, keep your head down. Don't get involved. Over the past 2 months, our nation has witnessed a wave of protest in every corner of our land. People are marching in the streets to voice their opposition to systemic racial injustice. They are demanding that the injustices of the past be removed from God's holy meadow, so that all in our country, no matter who they are, may enjoy true justice, God's justice. If we hope to inhabit God's kingdom, if we hope to enjoy God's promise of salvation, which has been extended to all of us, if we hope, as Amos says, to live, then we must do as Amos commands us here. Hate evil. Love our God. And establish justice in the gate. Amen.